Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match two of your favorite breakfast items, including a sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and hash browns. Make it even better with a delicious medium iced coffee. With McDonald's mix and match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price.
Whether you're a morning person or a bedtime procrastinator, everyone deserves a mattress that works for their style. And you'll find the best mattress for you at Ashley. The new Tempur-Adapt collection at Ashley brings you one-of-a-kind body-conforming technology, making every sleep tailored to be your best. The collection also features cool-to-the-touch covers and motion absorption to help minimize sleep disruptions from partners, pets, or kids. Shop the all-new Tempur-Adapt collection at Ashley in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley. For the love of home.
Welcome to The Megyn Kelly Show, your home for open, honest, and provocative conversations. Hey everyone, I'm Megyn Kelly. Welcome to The Megyn Kelly Show. Today on the program, we've got Sam Harris. This guy is a philosopher, he's an author, he is host of the Making Sense podcast. And I would say more than anybody else, he is the name that has been suggested to me as a potential guest on the program. And I've listened to Sam in the past, but I was fascinated to see what is it about him that has made him so very popular with the people who listen to this podcast. And now I get it. Now I get it. He's a liberal, but he's not woke. And the way he talks about the woke is incredibly eloquent and thoughtful and smart. And you know, he's one of those guys that just makes you feel like, oh, why couldn't I put it that way? Super smart, very big brained guy. But he's very thoughtful. He's pensive. I think you'll find him illuminating on how, A, you could quiet your own mind and B, enrich it after you quiet it. may require you being quiet for 2 months in a row, but we'll talk about that later. But I think we had a good spirited exchange on things like Trump and his fans and sort of the media and their coverage of politicians and their, quote, lies. Anyway, we'll get to Sam in 1 second. But first, I want to talk to you about Jan Marini Skincare. You guys, this is a beautiful line of products. I myself tried them. And number one, they don't smell, which I like. I don't like a lot of odors in my products. Number two, they idiot-proof it for you. They tell you in the regimen, this one goes on in the morning, this one goes on in the evening. This one you can put on both. And so, you know how like you're a busy person, you don't have time. So like they walk you through it. So Jan Marini Skin Research is a recognized leader and an innovator in skincare. The easy to use products keep your skin feeling nice and refreshed, nice and hydrated. You don't get like shiny. And the Jan Marini buzz is that it's one of the fastest growing professional skincare brands in recent years. That's what everybody's saying about it. And it's true because it's gotten a bunch of awards. It's used by multiple movie and TV production sets. It's being used on the set of Spider-Man, I guess. Yay. And it's a 5-step daily care system. You cleanse, you rejuvenate, you resurface, you hydrate, and you protect. Their skincare management system has been awarded 10 consecutive years by New Beauty Magazine as best skincare system for aging skin. Jan Marini Skin Research has earned more beauty awards from New Beauty than any other skincare company. The products are hydrating, they're calming. They have numerous clinical studies conducted by leading dermatologists, and you can get them anywhere, really. They're at med spas, aesthetic offices, spas throughout the country. So go to janmarini.com to find locations near you or purchase directly from the website. Plus, they've got some great holiday offerings available and always with just 2-day free shipping. Transform your skin with Jan Marini. And now, Sam Harris. Really excited to talk to you and also a little nervous because I've been watching a lot of your interviews and listening to your podcasts, and you seem like an intellectual giant, and I'm feeling ill-equipped to talk to you.
Well, listen, I want to put you at your ease because, first of all, I think you and I agree about many things, and I'm a fan of yours. I'm happy to talk to you about anything, and where we disagree, I think it'll be fun. So let's just okay. Go.
Good. Okay, I feel a little better. I like to start where I can with news of the day, and you've been so smart and easy to listen to on the topic of wokeness and the religion of wokeness. And just today, we saw a school in Virginia, an elementary school, announcing that it is dropping part of its name, Thomas Jefferson, Quote, mm-hmm. due to the pain his legacy can cause, not even actually is causing, but can cause Black students, despite an overwhelming majority of the parents saying, we don't want this. We are not in favor of this at all, but it's happening. And then here in New York, it was announced not long ago that at one of these sort of expensive private schools, it's actually happening at more than one, parents must now outline their commitment to anti-racism when applying, and they have to attend anti-racist training before they can even get into the school. The anti-racist label is a rhetorical trick. So does all of this concern you? I know you've got daughters and you're concerned about wokeness in general, but I think in the schools it's especially pernicious.
Yeah, well, it does. I mean, I think we should just bracket, you know, all the heresy we're about to download with an acknowledgement that racism is real and it's a problem, and it's been an excruciating problem throughout our history, right? So it's not mysterious, this kind of moral panic we're seeing around the issue of racism now. I mean, we know what the past was like. The problem is that people seem to not want to acknowledge the progress we've made, right? So there's something deranging about acting like this is 1964, right? Given all that's happened in the last 50 years. You know, we had a two-term Black president, and that counts for absolutely nothing. We have a generation that's acting like, you know, being on the 3-yard line with respect to racism is, you know, a moment of moral emergency, right? So I'm not saying that racism is gone. I'm not saying that there are no ways in which there may be policies that disadvantage people in various groups. And we want to untangle all that and respond to all that. But we have made enormous progress, and there are just not that many racists out there, right, who want racist outcomes, you know, starkly unequal and unfair outcomes for people. And so to not acknowledge that is deranging. And so now we have a kind of an activist cohort in our society. It's not clear just what percentage of American society it is, but it doesn't have to be all that big to completely derail our conversation about these issues. And yeah, so now, you know, defenestrating Thomas Jefferson or you know, anyone else from our history who's obviously record on race was imperfect, to say the least, but still you can't discount the fact that this is one of the most important people in American history, and still the person who made, you know, an outsized contribution to creating our country. So it's this particular activism makes no sense, and yeah, it's deeply concerning that these are educators, these are people who will be teaching children almost without fail at this point to view the world through the lens of race in a way that you know arguably was appropriate 50 years ago, but really isn't appropriate now. It's in fact totally dysfunctional now.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it's, some of the critics have said this is David Duke's dream realized, where everything really is about skin color. It's immutable. It's not overcomable. It makes all the difference in character and how well you can do in society. You know, the differences are innate and should dominate anyone's perception of another just upon first meeting them. And that's where we're going. And I know you've said, I thought you made an interesting statement, because you're not big on false claims of victimhood. And you were saying they can diminish the social stature of any group, including one that really has been victimized. And so constantly, as you say, you know, we're on the 3-yard line with race, constantly pretending that we're not, that we're still all the way down the playing field, can actually set a group back. I mean, it's setting back race relations and Black people as a group.
Yeah, because it's dishonest, right? It's just, it's not, and it also just, it just violates the basic principle that will get us into the end zone. I mean, to let's just acknowledge what the goal is here. The goal is to wake up in a world where these superficial differences between people, the skin color, has absolutely no moral or political significance, right? That was certainly MLK's dream, and it should be ours, right? And activists on this issue and a host of other issues as well are acting like these differences between people are indelible, morally important, politically essential to recognize at every turn, and that any disparity we see in our society, you know, if we inventory our Fortune 500 companies and our various professions, and we find that there's not a perfect representation of the general population in all of those places, right? If exactly 50% of cardiologists are not women, if exactly 13-14% of people in the C-suite at Apple aren't Black, right? The only explanation for this is bigotry, right? Now, that is just, there are many things wrong with that, but first is that it is almost certainly untrue, right? I mean, at minimum, you would need real evidence to make that allegation. And there's so many other explanations that promote themselves here. And it's so, the dishonesty of it is toxic, not to mention the fact that seeing yourself as a victim perpetually and locating your social power, your status in victimhood, which is really the algorithm that is running here, it's intrinsically divisive, right? I mean, if your politics is based on the politics of identity rather than looking for solutions that benefit everybody, looking for systems that are intrinsically fair, right? You can't possibly converge with other people because all you're doing is ramifying your differences. So you're viewing everything as zero sum in principle. And it's just, it's regressive. And it doesn't acknowledge any of the progress we've made or the principles by which we've made that progress.
Mm-hmm. One of the problems we're having is the complete stifling of conversation on this and the messaging to white people and often white men that you just can't speak. If you're white, you shouldn't speak on the issue of race. If you're a man, you shouldn't speak on the issue of sexism. If you're cis, meaning you identify with your biological sex that you were born with, you shouldn't speak on the issue of transgender and so on. And it's a really effective way of silencing people in those groups because you're told if you even try to speak out about it, never mind speak out critically, if you dare say anything critical of it, you've offended just by opening your mouth. You've offended. And I know this summer when we were in the midst of the BLM protests and defund the police cries and all that, you were very outspoken in a very, very powerful podcast that I've listened to a few times. And you made a point up front about saying it was a conscious choice not to put on a Black scholar, an intellectual, to talk to you and to make these points for you, with you, across from you, because you want to disabuse people of this perception that the color of one's skin matters for a discussion on race, or that, you know, your gender has to determine whether you can speak up on trans or et cetera. I thought that was really brave. And I think more of us need to say that.
Yeah. I mean, you know, my bravery is to some degree founded on the fact that I've taken prudent steps to not be cancelable, right? So in the end, mm-hmm. it's not all that much bravery, to be honest, because I knew what I wanted to be able to do, and I've taken steps to ensure that I run a fairly low risk of suffering some, you know, fatal error, you know, career wise, for doing it. So, And I mean, as you know, you've had adventures in cancellation, and it's, you know, I mean, you're an example I've actually spoken about. I mean, someone at the absolute top of media saying one thing and being hurled from the ramparts for it. And, you know, and I would say, you know, it was a malicious framing of what you said. And I mean, perhaps we can, I don't know if you want to talk about that, but I think there's the underlying problem here is that people want to hold people to the least charitable interpretation of what they've said or done at every turn. And they're really not concerned to know what was actually intended, what was actually going on in their minds, or what their real aims are, right? So if you can discover that someone has said something that can possibly be construed as racist or sexist or transphobic or whatever it is, well, then that possible construal is the thing that you will amplify as an activist or even as a journalist now. And the goal is just complete obliteration of a person's reputation and an obvious aim to make them unhireable. I saw the writing on the wall there, and I have kind of created a platform for myself where I can say more or less anything I want. But yeah, the reality is that if you are a white guy who is talking about, in this case, police violence against everyone, but in particular young black men, you have to be on the back foot to even think you should be saying something, especially at a moment as fraught as the immediate aftermath of the George Floyd killing. But the truth is, the color of a person's skin has absolutely no relevance to a conversation about the actual statistics of police violence and crime and violence in our society. And it's bizarre and dysfunctional to think it does have relevance there. And, we have, on that particular point, we are suffering a kind of public hysteria around this topic. I'm not saying there isn't too much police violence. I'm not saying that many of our cops are poorly trained and we should be hiring, better recruits and training them better. And far from defunding the police, we should give them more funds to recruit better people and to train them better. But the flip side of that is the cops have the hardest job in the world, practically, right? I mean, they're thrust into situations that the public, don't understand how to interpret, right? I mean, we're in a country where there are 400 million guns on the streets. This is not like policing in Japan, where you can assume when the guy turns around and races to the front seat of his car, he's not going to pull out a handgun. In fact, you have to assume that he will in this case, right? So mm-hmm. Cops are in all these situations where they have to make split second decisions about what someone's doing with their hands. And it's, yes, they kill 1,000 people every year, but they don't kill people in a way that suggests that there's an epidemic of racist violence perpetrated by racist cops in our society. That's not what the data show. And yet to say that in the aftermath of George Floyd, I think it was rightly perceived as risky. And, many people would have been fired for recording a podcast like that, but happily I have taken pains to be unfireable.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, the whole stifling of conversation around COVID first and the riots over the summer, Black Lives Matter, the gender stuff, this is really what made me want to get back out there, just get in front of a microphone again, because the more you tell me I can't say something, the more I want to say it. And I've always been that way. My executive producer, Tom Lowell, used to say to me at Fox, MK, you like to go to the place that hurts. And it was true. It wasn't gratuitous. It was because when no one wants to talk about a thing, to me, it becomes ever more important to talk about the thing. There's nothing wrong with talking about the thing. And we've gone completely crazy on this, where just talking is a fireable offense, just a fireable offense. Just talking about something can get you fired. It's it isn't right. And it scares me that so many people have, forgive the term, bent the knee on that. They don't talk anymore. They're afraid.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, this is a great inoculation against this comes in certain areas of academia, although I got to imagine those are closing down a little bit now. But, you know, having a background in philosophy, you know, in a philosophy seminar, you know, just as thought experiments, you can talk about anything, right? Because you're probing for the foundations of ethics, right? You're trying to figure out what makes something wrong, you know, if in fact things can truly be wrong in this world, you know, as I think they can. In a philosophy seminar, you might say, well, you know, why can't, you know, what is the difference between abortion and infanticide? And, you know, why can't people kill their children if they don't want them anymore, right? You know, if they do it, you know, within 15 minutes of birth, right? If abortion is legal. I mean, so these are the kinds of things, sentences you would speak in a room filled with people searching to understand ethics. And yet now one would fear that somebody would just, you know, to take that quote out of context and say, well, look at this maniac. He doesn't understand why you can't kill babies, right? And it's, we need to be able to speak without being paranoid. And we need our actual intentions to matter. I mean, it's not that hard to figure out if somebody is actually racist, and racist in a way that should matter, right? Or actually sexist, you know, sexist in a way that should matter. And people don't tend to conceal this stuff, right? And people should be held accountable for what they really are trying to do to the world, right? So it's the fact that a bad joke or something that can be misunderstood or an honest question of confusion can get spun into a career-ending, reputation-canceling offense. Maybe that was always possible in some way, but it does seem genuinely new in the way that it achieves scale based on, you know, our new technology. I mean, just social media has leveraged this into something that's deeply unhealthy for us as a society, and we have to find some way to pull back.
Well, I know you've said all we have between us and the total breakdown of civilization is successful conversations. That's, and we're on the brink. But it made me think because, you know, having been in media for a long time, I do wonder whether these conversations are working, the ones that we were having before the complete shutdown of all of them, and even the ones that we're starting to have now. You know, there have been studies that say people don't want to hear opposing ideas. They try to avoid listening to them. That's why we have Fox News and CNN and MSNBC on the other side. People go there for confirmation bias and just to feel good about themselves. It's like hearing the sweet nothings about how right you are. And I really wonder whether we've leaned so far into that conversation's over. It's canceled. Conversation's canceled.
Yeah, well, so I do think conversation is the only tool we have to ensure that 8 billion of us can collaborate in an open-ended way. I mean, is the human project truly open-ended? You know, is it possible that we're going to get through this century and into the next million years of conscious life, you know, that is, you know, directly descended from who we are now? I mean, you know, whether we will be recognizably human at that point is certainly an open question. But, you know, is this project doomed, and is it doomed in the near term, or are we going to thrive in some truly open-ended way? I think conversation is really the whole story that will decide whether, you know, which future we land in here, because it is the only thing that allows us to modify the behavior of perfect strangers without violence, right? We have a choice between conversation and violence in all its forms, coercion, right? So, laws are also a form of violence in the end. You know, if we pass a law against you doing or saying certain things, well, what happens when you break that law? I mean, people show up to your house with guns, and if you do the wrong thing with your hands, you might get shot, right? So it's we have our ability to persuade one another based on common principles of reasoning and appeal to facts that can be mutually appreciated, or we have force. And we should be very slow to make an appeal to force for obvious reasons. So we have to get better at speaking to one another about difficult issues, and we appear to be getting worse at it. And we appear to have crafted an information ecosystem in the media and social media now that is has all of the signs of being a psychological experiment to which no one consented, whose purpose is to see how crazy it can make us. Right? I mean, we're now in mutually canceling and irreconcilable echo chambers, and there are many of them. And just to look at what's happening now currently in our politics around the election, and what has been happening for 4 years under Trump, we're seeing a fragmentation of media and social media. And in the case of social media, we've built platforms that have been maliciously gamed, where the echo chamber effect can be accentuated by the very business model. So it really is something that we have to get straight. And I think the prospect of us just maintaining this particular course, where we're this fragmented, where it's this difficult to talk about the most important things that face us, a pandemic, right? We can't even figure out how to talk to one another about what we should do in the face of a pandemic, right? And that's and trust in our institutions has eroded, right? And for obvious reasons, but for reasons that we have to figure out how to nullify, right? So I'm going to take something that will be, I would imagine, dear to the hearts of many of your listeners. I mean, the hypocrisy of public health officials, right, where they castigate people protesting lockdown as being, murderously irresponsible for having gone out in public without masks, or gone out in large groups at all to express their political opinions. The way that flipped when the protests were for Black Lives Matter, and you have the same public health officials in many cases by the thousands signing open letters in support of these protests, which, from an epidemiological perspective, were just as crazy, in fact, probably far crazier than any of the protests that were happening in protest over lockdown. It harms the stature of our most important organs of information in a pandemic, right? If science is going to be that politicized, it's easy to see how trust breaks down.
More with Sam in just 1 second, but first, let's talk Bloomsy Box. Are you still struggling with what to buy your mom or your family member or your long-lost friend for the holidays? Here is a great idea. You can send flowers from Bloomsy Box. Your loved one is going to light up when they get your flowers, and they're going to show them to all their friends because they're spectacular and they're special. These are not your average flowers. They are better blooms. You're not going to believe the look on somebody's face when your Bloomsy Box flowers arrive. It's kind of magical. And the reason is they're sustainably grown on family farms around the world. So you place your order, your flowers are handpicked, they're arranged at the farm just for you. It's like sending a personal one-of-a-kind flower gift. And they are delivered farm fresh, straight to your loved one's door. I'm going to do this for my mom. So she's going to get them, and they're not going to die in 2 days like you get in New York City. They're going to last because they came from the local farm. Get an incredible price, a huge selection of artisan-designed arrangements. There are no hidden fees, no endless upsells, and free shipping with your subscription. So check it out, whether you're going to send a single holiday arrangement or a subscription for someone special to receive flowers every month, you got to go with Bloomsybox. And I got you a special discount. Go to bloomsybox.com and enter MK to get 15% off and free shipping. That's promo code MK for 15% off at bloomsybox.com.
There is a difference between the way the New York Times tries to get its facts straight, even when it fails, than something like Breitbart or Fox News or any organ of pseudo news on the right. And that asymmetry is something that, you know, we have to figure out how to correct because it's shattering our society.
Do you think CNN and MSNBC are in the New York Times camp?
No, I think they're worse. I think they're obviously worse most of the time. MSNBC is obviously worse. CNN is often worse. I find them both more or less unwatchable now. I mean, I never watched MSNBC, frankly, but I think we have to be honest about why this is, I'm sure you know my opinion of Trump, I think Trump really is it is true to say that he is the most dishonest and corrupt person who has appeared in public life in our country in our lifetime. I think that is a fact about him. This is not, I don't think that's just my opinion. I don't think this is really debatable. I mean, I think it's like saying he's got a vaguely orange hue to his skin or fairly colorful hair. These are facts about him that you can observe based on being able to observe him for now decades, right? I'm not talking just about the last 4 years. I think he's not a normal politician. He's not a normal person in this specific regard. And his level of dishonesty and his level of selfishness, I mean, the malignancy of his self-concern, right? And everything gets sucked into that kind of moral black hole around him, right? And he attracts people into his orbit who will put up with that. Right, you know, people who are, for their own reasons, are willing to, who don't view that as the moral and political abomination that it actually is, and the media has had to figure out how to respond to this, and I would be the first to say that they've done a terrible job, and it has been deranging for them, right? Because when they see that he's he functions by a very different physics, reputationally. He's managed to dissect out a kind of, a personality cult within our society.
Now I got to stop you. I got a couple thoughts. I would suggest to you that one of the reasons you don't see Hillary Clinton as in the running for most dishonest, corrupt politician ever is because, in part, the way the media didn't cover that. They run cover for their favorite Democrats, like we saw with the Hunter Biden story, which has now come out as confirmed. The FBI has been looking into him, reportedly looking into foreign dealings, possible money laundering, a story that Twitter and Facebook and the other media outlets wouldn't even touch. We were told it was untrue. We were told it was a smear. It was an October surprise, not based in fact. Well, guess what? That's not true. And Hillary Clinton, at the time, she wasn't the most beloved Democratic candidate, but once it was her versus Trump, they were all in on protecting her, stories about the Clinton Foundation. She lied every 2 minutes, but we didn't have a lie ticker going on her because the media wasn't interested in doing that. Cheryl Atkinson was just on talking about that, about this reporter who was telling her, we calculated out how many times Trump lies, and this is the number of lies per minute. And she said, how many for Hillary? This is when they were running against each other. They said, oh, well, we didn't have the time or the staff to do that. Well, it might be interesting. She doesn't have an adult relationship with the truth either. I don't argue that Trump is truthful, not for one second. And I understand he may be in a special category. But yeah, he may not be as far ahead of people like Hillary as you think.
No, I mean, I would definitely dispute that. Well, first, I'll say you're not going to find much of a defense of Hillary Clinton or the Clintons as a couple in me. I mean, I completely get why people were allergic to her and her candidacy. And it was a lesser of two evils, you know, choice from my point of view, but it was much lesser for a host of reasons, not just to this difference in dishonesty and you know, personal corruption. But it's just, I mean, the ordinary range of lying and self-dealing and you know, perverse incentives and all the stuff we recognize in many, if not most, politicians, we have a sense of the general shape of that, right? And I get that if you scratch the surface on most of the people in power and then certainly most of the people who seek the office, right? I mean, it is kind of, it's a self-selecting group, and there are people, you know, who are in this game for the wrong reasons, and it's just many of the incentives are perverse, and yeah, it's not glamorous, right? It's hard to be idealistic about many of these people, and I would say the Clintons were especially cynical, and yes, there's a lot of dishonesty that you can find in their backstories, but it's Trump is orders of magnitude worse. I mean, he's done literally hundreds of things, any one of which would have destroyed the political prospects of any other normal politician.
Well, that's true. But what I'm saying to you is that when you say we have a sense of what these politicians were and how far, you know, down the dishonesty lane they were, I'm just positing to you that you should put an asterisk there, because I think the media has exposed itself during the Trump era, and I think they have gone nuts. They've taken their dishonesty to a new level because they are deranged by him. But their bias has always been there. And I do think it's worthwhile for people to stop and ask themselves how they've been manipulated, how their perception of a politician like Hillary or Barack Obama was manipulated by the glowing coverage they received in general from outlets like the New York Times. And to your second point that you were making earlier about when I asked you about CNN and MSNBC, they don't get a pass for, you know, well, they're nuts, but he drove them to it. Well, too bad. That doesn't, you know, some of us had a very difficult time with Trump, and some of us were not huge fans of his for personal reasons, right? But you can get past that if you're a strong person and you're an ethical person. You understand what the job of a journalist is, which is not to make it about yourself. And what we saw here with CNN and MSNBC was not a couple of journalists fell. You know, like Jim Acosta, who used to be a straight news guy, he fell. He just went totally partisan, got the derangement syndrome, couldn't be relied upon for truth anymore. They all went down, all of them. I was like, it was shocking to me to see somebody like Anderson Cooper sacrifice his credibility because of what appeared to be his inability to see Trump in any way that approached fair. So I don't, you know, I felt like you may have been sort of trying to explain their surrender to their nonstop attacks on him by, well, he drove them to it. They drove themselves to it.
I would just say that the asymmetry here really is difficult to navigate. So, I mean, for instance, just to take the Hillary Clinton coverage, I think the media is rightly concerned that they got Trump elected, right? I mean, they gave Trump something, some insane ratio of coverage. I mean, something like 20 times the amount of coverage that they gave. I can't remember if that was for Clinton or for Bernie Sanders, but there's some comparison between the amount of airtime Trump got, you know, in 2016.
It was the other GOP candidates in the primary.
Okay. So it's just, they did that, right? And they have good reason to worry whether that was counterproductive given what they wanted to happen in the election. And also, it's I think it's fairly well established at this point that the Comey, reactivation of the email investigation, whatever it was, 11 days before the election in 2016, the coverage of that and the sort of the scrupulosity of that moment, both from the FBI side and from the press's side, like, oh yeah, we really got to talk about this now from, you know, yet another 24-hour news cycle when there's only 10 days left. Let's talk about Hillary Clinton's emails. They rightly think that that probably cost her the election. Right now, obviously, there are many other things that, you know, cost her the election. She was a terrible candidate, and
she didn't go to Wisconsin.
Yeah, you could say that her unelection was overdetermined. But when the people who were tracking the polls in those last days of the campaign just saw the direct effect, or at least now claim to have seen the direct effect of that coverage. So it's given that history. Yeah, what do you do with a Hunter Biden story? Right, it's a hard problem,
It isn't hard. You're so much more forgiving of these people than I am. First of all, it was very obvious that they were giving Trump too much free airtime. Even to me, I was a person responsible for putting points on the board when it came to ratings during the Trump rise, the GOP primary, and thereafter. And this is in my book, but we had many a meeting, my executive producer, my team, and I did, about the need to stop, to pull ourselves away from the crack cocaine. You know, like Trump was amazing television. Every time you put him on television, the ratings soared, but it wasn't fair because Scott Walker was terrible television and incredibly boring to watch. I like him. I like him just for the record, but he is not a dynamic television personality. And it was totally unfair what we were doing. So even though we wanted the crack cocaine, we didn't snort it, right? We made a conscious decision to try to get ratings the old-fashioned way, which was interesting debate and reporting the news in an entertaining way, but not putting our thumb on the scale. They did it intentionally. They knew what they were doing. Jeff Zucker knew what he was doing. Noah Oppenheim knew what he was doing on the Today Show, allowing Trump to phone in, to do phoners as a presidential candidate when nobody else would have been afforded that, right? They did it for ratings. They sold their souls out for numbers. Joe and Mika, too. They kissed Trump's ass when he was running. Why? Because their numbers would soar on a show that was not doing well. So I don't forgive them one bit of that. In other words, I don't allow them to use that to justify their overcompensation and trying to ruin him every moment of his presidency. They made their bed and they needed to lie in it. And the Hunter Biden story was very clearly legitimate. He had never denied it. There was an FBI subpoena that was verifiable. There were third-party witnesses who had come forward to say, I participated in this and let me tell you about it, whose credibility was not assailable. They just didn't want to do it. They didn't want to do anything that could hurt Biden.
Yeah. Well, I understand it. I mean, I've always made an effort to be fair in my criticism of Trump, because I do think it's, I mean, I think intellectual honesty is the master value here. And if you think he's racist, well then, you know, argue on based on real evidence that he's racist and not pseudo evidence, right? And I think it's, you know, and this is true for anything else you might want to allege about him. But I think that, you know, the worst problem with him beyond anything else that he's done or tried to do is the way in which our trust in our institutions and a whole style of speaking and thinking about institutions has just fully eroded. I mean, we're just, you know, it seems that half the country thinks we don't need institutions anymore, right? And that we can
Let me ask you about this. So I've been following this too, and I've been experiencing it myself as a citizen to some extent, not fully, but to some extent, right? Because take Comey and the FBI. I defended Jim Comey. I thought he was a man of honor. The whole story of Robert Mueller and Comey and, you know, having each other's backs and protecting each other and whatever, the ethical quandaries they faced and rose above. I defended him, and now I see him as a partisan hack. I really do. I've completely changed on him. I defended the FBI. I know a lot of these FBI agents. I tend to defer to law enforcement. I have law enforcement in my family, and I think a lot of women are deferential to law enforcement for reasons having to do with nonstop crimes being played on the evening news as we were growing up. But that's just my armchair theory. Anyway, then I saw the Peter Strzok emails and the other emails coming out from the FBI and how partisan they were and how determined they were to bring down Trump. And I thought, maybe I have been too deferential. Maybe Trump kicking these tires is not such a bad thing. Maybe we have been too trusting in these institutions. And of course, we've discussed media and how people were trusting media in a way they shouldn't have been. I agree it's gone too far. I don't think you throw out the baby with the bathwater, right? I think we're sort of now at the point where we trust no one and we've become conspiratorial and things are getting weird. There's becoming like a cult-like love for Trump that where in which he looks deified, that's concerning. And therefore his offhanded need to attack every institution that says something bad about him or does something he doesn't like, or person, you know, Governor Kemp of Georgia, who's his fan, it isn't healthy. I see all of that. But how do you ascribe, you know, how do you deal with those revelations of dishonesty versus maintaining a country in which we do have to trust institutions and move forward?
Well, I just think you have to put them in their proper perspective, right? So again, what you drill down on anything, I mean, you start reading people's private emails or emails they thought were going to be private. You start reading their texts. Yes, there's no question you're going to find things that you know are embarrassing and are all too human, and that's totally understandable. I mean, these things weren't intended for public consumption, right? So, you know, a hack of the DNC or you know, subpoenaing people's text messages when you're investigating, you know, anyone, you know, attorneys or members of the FBI, yeah, you'll find evidence of bias and all of that, right? So, but that no one's surprised by that. What people should be surprised by is, you know, to take one institution in particular, your election, and all the systems that support it. We should be surprised that we have a sitting president who, in the run-up to the election, would not commit to a peaceful transfer of power in the event that he lost. And then on election night, with millions of votes still coming in, claimed to have won, right? And demanded that the voting be stopped, right? Or that the ballots, you know, the ballot counting stop. If you just make a little documentary about that moment and what it says about where we've come and the divergent reactions to that in our society, right? The fact that we had something like half of the society that simply didn't care this was happening, or they had some construal of it where this is not only benign, this is good, right? He's disrupting everything now. Now he's disrupting our expectations about the peaceful transfer of power and the integrity of our elections, right? He's calling a fraud on an election that is in process, you know, where we haven't seen any evidence of fraud yet, right? He called the election he won in 2016 fraudulent. And that's, you know, this should be the lens through which we look at everything that has happened subsequently in the last month and a half or so, right? It's not that if you don't go looking for fraud, you'll never find it. Of course, that there's going to be some ambient level of election fraud. That there will be, and there'll be crazy behavior. And if you put yourself in a position to just look for crazy behavior, you will find it. But the question is, can you find it at a scale that reveals this election to be completely fraudulent? You know, there's no evidence for that at the moment.
No, I get it. But I have to say, I think that I look at the media that's how we're learning about the substance of these election fraud claims, right? We need to trust them to tell us what has he filed? What is the court saying? Does he have the proof? It's the same as those doctors who justified the BLM protests coming out now, telling us to stay inside and not go shoulder to shoulder. We're looking at them saying, I don't believe you anymore. You already sacrificed your credibility. I don't know who to believe. But when confused with who to believe, people do revert to tribalism. They go to the person who's wearing their team jersey. And I think that's why a lot of these Republicans who have lost all trust in media are believing Trump, even though I've said on this show many times, I don't think any of his claims are robust. There's been a couple, the last one he filed in the state of Georgia that challenged like the failure to match up the signatures and how many votes were thrown out versus in prior elections. And it went down this year, even though the vote was five times higher by mail, blah, blah, blah. You could make an argument on a couple of them, right? So we're trying to give him his due without losing touch with reality. But I completely understand why people, that it's gone. Their trust in the information deliverers is gone. And just for the record, the FBI thing was not just the Peter Strzok emails, but as you know, an FBI agent pleaded guilty for doctoring a subpoena. They got subpoenas in the case against Trump from the FISA court by using the dossier, which had been discredited, and they knew it wasn't true. Like, there were a lot of things that were exposed. Why? Because Trump fought back. And he made outlandish claims at the time that weren't true in defending himself, but he wasn't guilty. That was the truth at the end of the day. And same thing with impeachment. There's just been so many overreaches in order to destroy him that, in essence, they've endowed him with the credibility to come out and challenge anything. I don't excuse Trump for throwing wild claims around. I'm just, in the way you're trying to explain the media's distorted minefield when it comes to Trump, I'm trying to explain why he now has this ultimate credibility with all these folks, because the other side is just, it's collapsed. The information deliverers have collapsed, and it matters.
Yeah, well, it does matter. It hasn't completely collapsed. And I think people need to be sensitive to the difference between, you know, plausible interpretations of events and, you know, completely unprincipled conspiratorial, you know, tinfoil hat, crazy interpretation of events. And there are reasons why we have this category of conspiracy theories that doesn't subsume all of our thinking about everything all the time, right? And there's a reason why there's a stigma associated with conspiracy thinking, because it reliably manufactures errors, right? It rests on not acknowledging the power of incentives, right? And so to take the case of the election fraud conspiracy, right? Now, again, I'm not saying there isn't some level of fraud, but there are many reasons to think that whatever level of fraud there is, it almost certainly happens on both sides in the election, right? There's not a lot of incentive for individuals to commit fraud, there doesn't seem to be the apparatus to allow us to really commit it at scale across multiple states. And, you know, that's a good thing. I mean, obviously we want an election system that we can be confident in and that is designed in a way to truly minimize fraud and error. And this is a project we need to engage, if for no other reason than to restore confidence in our election system. But the reality is that all of this is happening in a context where many of the people in power, right, the governors, the secretaries of state, the legislators, the election officials, the judges who have to hear these cases, many of them are lifelong Republicans, right? Many of them surely voted for Trump in this election. And so you have you're arguing to be really conspiratorial about this. You're arguing that these people are somehow incentivized to risk going to prison in order to help Joe Biden.
Back to Sam in 1 second. But first, have you ever Googled yourself, your neighbors? The majority of Americans admit to keeping an eye on their online reputation, and why shouldn't you? But Google and Facebook are just the tip of the iceberg when it comes to finding public records. There is an innovative new website called TruthFinder, and it is now revealing the full scoop on millions of Americans. TruthFinder can search through hundreds of millions of public records in a matter of minutes. TruthFinder members can begin searching in seconds for sensitive data like criminal, traffic, and arrest records. Before you bring someone new into your life and around the people you care so deeply for, consider trying TruthFinder. What you may find may astound you. This might be the most important web search that you ever do, so do it. Go to truthfinder.com/Kelly right away to start searching and be prepared for what you find. Again, that's truthfinder.com/Kelly. Okay, we're going to get back to Sam in a second, but first we want to bring you this feature we call Sound Up, where we talk about some of the sound bites making the news or that we think are interesting and want to share with you. And today we are going to talk about Hunter Biden. Remember old Hunter Biden? If not, you could be excused since it was a story that was totally buried by the mainstream media. CNN, Politico, others reported last week that Joe Biden's son is being investigated by the FBI. His taxes, his dealing with China, money laundering, and more. We don't know how deep this goes, but it doesn't sound good. The story has a lot of the same hallmarks as the New York Post's reporting on Hunter Biden in October. Remember that? It was a big scoop. And it was about what was on the Hunter Biden laptop. That story, however, which was published before the election, was suppressed, totally censored by Twitter, Facebook, and other social outlets. Basically, no one wanted to go with this. It wasn't just social. It was print magazines and print newspapers and television. Nobody wanted to touch this thing. They decided it was not to be discussed. And they said it was because it was unreliable, but the truth is more likely that it was bad for Joe Biden. Anything bad for Joe Biden has to be suppressed, according to the media. So how did the media treat the story at that time, prior to the election? Listen to some MSNBC highlights.
Watch for President Trump to go after former Vice President Joe Biden's son, Hunter Biden, and unverified emails about his business dealings, a story that many intelligence experts say has all the hallmarks of a foreign interference campaign.
When there is a New York Post article that is false, it's much better for Twitter to let people read the New York Post article and sit there and laugh at the hokey story of a computer repairman looking at a computer going, this sure does look suspicious to me. I'm going to call Rudy Giuliani. Like, let that out, okay? Because people will read this story and then they'll go, this is really one of the stupidest October surprises I've ever seen before. What did he have, x-ray vision?
Oh my God, why when they're trying to portray a dumb person do they always put on a Southern accent? It's so irritating. Honestly, and then they're like, me, an elite? Oh, wait, I love being an elite. Yes, I am. Screw everybody else. Anyway, so that was Morning Joe. Here's Christian Amanpour at CNN, who seems to forget the role of a journalist.
As you know perfectly well, I'm a journalist and a reporter, and I follow the facts. And there has never been any issues in terms of corruption. Now, let me ask you this. Yesterday, the FBI...
How do you know that?
I'm talking about reporting and any evidence. I'm talking to you now.
Okay, I would love if you guys would start doing that digging and start doing that verification.
No, we're not going to do your work for you. I want to ask you a question.
There's no reports. So we can't report on it. Why were there no reports again? Oh, because it was buried by people like you who just decided without investigating it that it was untrue. Well, guess what? The FBI's been investigating it. And frankly, it looks like they've been investigating it for a long, long time. Because in order to get the subpoena, to get that Hunter Biden laptop from the legally blind guy who was repairing it, remember, Hunter left his laptop there and he never went back. And finally, the FBI came in and got it. That was back in December of 19. So for the FBI to have gotten that, it suggested that they had an open investigation on Hunter Biden. That's how the FBI can't just like randomly throw out subpoenas. Back in December of 19, which they would have known had they bothered to look at it at all. But no, it was the New York Post. That's a Rupert Murdoch publication. So this has got to be a lie. And, you know, Jack at Twitter, who's got some far left guy deciding what gets censored, spoke out and said, no, we're not going to do it. And so the media lemmings followed. And now it turns out it's a very big story. And if it were a Republican, they'd be treating it like it were white hot. So now, fear not. Now they're on it. You got Politico, you got CNN. They are on it now that Joe Biden appears to be headed to the White House. Not surprising. Back to Sam. I've been thinking about it when it comes to race, and we've been talking about it on the show when it comes to gender. And the reason the gender thing is important is because the scientific world has collapsed too, right? Like, science is done. And you're not allowed to say that there are only two genders and there's only two biological sexes. And you're not allowed to question whether it might not be healthy to put a girl who suddenly at age 14 for the first time says she might actually be a boy on puberty blockers or cross-sex hormones, or allow her to get, quote, top surgery, you know, before she's even reached her 18th birthday. because that's not allowed. So you go to a scientist, you go to a psychiatrist to check out whether that's true for your daughter. And the standard of care is for him to just affirm, yes, you're trans, you're trans, you're trans. These are the standards of care. It drives me insane. And I know you're a neuroscientist. We had Deborah Sell on the program talking about how she left the field. She's now a journalist covering that field because she didn't think she could say what was scientifically true. I feel like people feel they need to fight back. You know, if Biden gets in there, we're going to see the return and the emboldened nature of all of this. No one's going to shut them down. You've got people like you, Sam, who speak honestly about the dicey issues. You're obviously a Democrat, a liberal, but you speak honestly about those issues. But so few people do that people are getting hurt now. In the scientific field, they're getting hurt. What do you make of that?
Yeah, well, a few things here. One is scientists are just people, right? And not everything they do is science. So, you know, you have scientists who express their opinions on many topics, and, you know, as I have here on many topics, and it's not, you know, there's no guarantee that what they're saying is, you know, scientifically defensible or convergent with what they would say when they have to put their scientist hat on. And mm-hmm. yes, I would agree with you that it is it's very costly to the reputation of science and any specific institution, you know, scientific journals, you know, when they express opinions that are at minimum, you know, highly debatable in terms of their, you know, ethical integrity and connection to science. And it's wrapped up in the mantle of, you know, this is now a scientific opinion, right? So that's a problem. And there, you know, there are many issues that, you know, some of which you just raised, where they're fraught issues for a reason. It's hard to know what to do about certain things. I mean, you take the transgender issue, right? You know, I have no doubt that transgenderism is a real phenomenon, right? It's not just made up. It's not just a product of culture. It's correct. Not just a social contagion. But is there a degree of social contagion riding on top of a real phenomenon that we have to worry about? I mean, specifically with the issue you mentioned of, I'm sure, I think you're probably referencing Abigail Schreier's book there. Yeah. And just, you know, just among girls transitioning to being boys or wanting to. Yeah, that has to be discussable, right? And, you know, as her efforts to get, you know, her side of this discussion out have shown, it's very hard to discuss, right? There are people who want to cancel her over this. And, you know, somebody like J.K. Rowling, you know, gets, you know, at least attempted, there's an attempted cancellation of her based on something, you know, absolutely benign she said about, you know, the trade-offs mm-hmm. between women's rights and trans rights. And I mean, there are trade-offs there. I mean, it's just there are moments that are hard to navigate based on appeals to, you know, the primacy of identity around those issues. And you know, when she was objecting to the corruption of language, where we can't talk about women anymore, we have to talk about people who menstruate.
Right.
You know, it is in fact true to say that if she were not this, you know, billion-dollar colossus of a writer, she probably would have had her career ruined over the absolutely anodyne thing she said about trans issues there. I mean, there's no evidence at all that she's remotely bigoted against trans people. So, yeah, the stuff is hard to talk about. And the only thing we can appeal to, really, if this is going to work, is a good faith engagement with facts and arguments. And let the best arguments and the most searching, honest engagement with facts win.
I heard John McWhorter on your show saying he believes these sort of wokesters are in good faith, that they think they're doing good. They're going to help you understand, you know, how racist you are, how transphobic you are. But he also said they're not persuadable. The only answer is to fight them. Do you agree with that?
Yeah, well, I think, and fight, by which he meant, in most cases, ignore them, you know, go around them, no longer give them any power. Mm-hmm. But you know, I have to think that more people are persuadable in the fullness of time. I mean, we're not dealing with a different species of person. You know, in all of these camps, we have recognizably human people who have been persuaded of certain dogmas or certain bad ideas, and they're not disposed to run the newest operating system that would debug these ideas, right? And mm-hmm. so we have to just keep advertising the importance of getting a firmware upgrade here. And it's true on both sides. And it's true on the far left, it's true on the right, or whatever you want to call Trumpistan. It's not clear how that relates to conservatism now, but I mean, to come back to a point you made earlier, I hold out hope for it being easier to deal with the wokeness and the hysteria on the left under Biden than under Trump, because Trump was such a super stimulus. You know, he was such a mm-hmm. such a confirmation of the worst fears, or an apparent confirmation of the worst fears of the left. I mean, because again, much of what has been alleged against him on those particular points, you know, with respect to race in particular, I think is not true, right? I mean, I happen to think, you know, I happen to believe Trump is a racist, but I don't think he's a white supremacist, and I don't think he has, you know, I think he's been unfairly tarred with, you know, the good people on both sides, or the fine people on both sides hoax. You know, that is, you know, you go back to that press conference, and yes, he did condemn white supremacists and neo-Nazis, clearly. My hope, certainly, if I had to bet money on it, I would say it's going to get easier under Biden to recognize how dysfunctional wokeness is politically and ethically, because they won't have Trump to point to, or won't have Trump to point to if he doesn't emerge in some other.
So far, it doesn't look like it's going that way. I mean, so far it does not look like it's going that way. You've got critical race theory is coming back thanks to what Biden says will be his first executive order, the mandated sessions at the federal government amongst its workers and its contractors. They're already saying that they're going to try to undo the restoration of due process rights for men who get accused on college campuses of sexual assault. Those are not good signs. Not at all.
No, no. And yeah, I mean, I just know what it's like. I know what it'll be like for someone like me to criticize all that without having to bracket everything I say with an acknowledgement of how crazy things are on the right. You know, it's just, it'll just be very easy to do. Now, maybe this wave is just now cresting. You know, maybe there is a bizarre effect here where when the problems get smaller and smaller, the people who are most focused on these problems get more and more agitated and more and act more and more like things have never been worse, right? It's on some level, this is the narcissism of small differences, right? I mean, just if you're not singing from precisely their hymn book, you know, on any of these woke issues, well, then you're a Nazi, right? And we're mm-hmm. talking about things like, you know, whether you can compliment someone on their hair, right? You know, is that a racist microaggression, right? We're not talking mm-hmm. about people getting lynched. We're not talking about, you know, people having to function under the rule of you know, race-based laws, right? We're talking about, off-color jokes. You know, someone gets into a elevator at an academic conference, and when they ask, you know, what floor, he says, women's lingerie, right? Like that is a right. life-deranging, cancelable offense because he offered up a dad joke from the 1950s. That's where we are, and it's eminently criticizable, right? And there's so many people. I mean, you know, to mention some of the black intellectuals who I didn't invite on that podcast. There's so many great people like John McWhorter and Glenn Lowry and Thomas Chatterton Williams and Coleman Hughes and, you know, many of you I know many of whom I know you've spoken with, and Camille Foster and Chloe Valdery and I mean, there are people who, you know, it shouldn't matter that the people I just mentioned mm-hmm. are Black, but it does matter, right? I mean, they really have an enormous responsibility, and they are shouldering it to perform an exorcism here, right? I mean, this is just because the people on the far left simply cannot hear it from people like us, right? I mean, if you're white and you know, obviously privileged, you know, you have all the privilege marks that could be, you know, ascribed against anyone in our society at this point, you by definition don't get it and can't talk about it. But there are many people who really can talk about it, and for whom they really are a kind of kryptonite, and it's not an accident that no one really wants to debate them. I mean, the people are not lining up to debate Glenn Lowry and John McWhorter about race issues or Shelby
or
Steele,
Coleman right? Hughes. Coleman Hughes, who's been out there saying, "Hey, Ibram X. Kendi, just let's talk about your book. I don't believe in it. I think you've made mistakes. You've been sloppy. Let's talk about it." And he won't debate Coleman Hughes, a 24-year-old guy who's done his homework, because he's afraid. But to your point earlier, they can't assail Glenn Lowry and Coleman and certainly Thomas Sowell in the way that they could come after you or me, but they won't hear from them. Number one, they get called Uncle Toms. Number two, they do not get invitations to appear on shows. No one's interested in putting them out there to say how they feel. And I'll just give you one other small example. It's a stupid story, but I am in the Bethlehem Central Hall of Fame. Perhaps you didn't know that, Sam, but
I did not know that. Now I'm intimidated.
I was inducted years ago. It's not Stanford, but it happened. And there's a push by some kids there to get me booted out. Why? Did I say, because I said something controversial about race? No, because I retweeted two prominent Black men who criticized the constant focus on race in this country. One was Jason Whitlock of OutKick, right? Formerly ESPN, a journalist who's super smart. He's coming on the show. I love Jason Whitlock. He's been brilliant on these issues and really brave and has been called an Uncle Tom by everybody. And one, Leonidas Johnson, who's got his own podcast. So now it's to the point where even retweeting these, you know, Black men with heterodox views of this race dogma is problematic, right? That's potentially cancelable. Whatever, they'll do what they're going to do. But I think no one wants to hear from them. Why isn't Coleman Hughes a household name? If he were saying the stuff the left wants to hear, he would be.
Yeah. Well, it's a problem. You know, I'll grant you that. It's been a problem for a long time on some adjacent issues. I mean, this is what happened to Ayaan Hirsi Ali, who I think you probably know.
She's my friend, and she was on the show recently.
Yeah, she's a dear friend of mine. And, you know, so, you know, when she was, you know, speaking critically about the treatment of women under Islam, and you'd think she would have standing to do this, having, you know, come out of Somalia and suffered, you know, all of the collateral damage of that experience that you might expect, and then literally recapitulating the entire Enlightenment project in her own life, and becoming a member of parliament in Holland, and then, you know, being hunted by jihadists and theocrats, and you know, essentially becoming the next Salman Rushdie. The left didn't want to hear from her, right? I mean, she was a much better candidate for taking a position in a left wing think tank than a right wing one. But only the AEI, the American Enterprise Institute, would give her a perch when she really needed one, right? And I, you know, while I don't agree with everything that comes out of that organization, I will never cease to be grateful to them for doing that. And you know, so she had this experience that many people have had, where when you begin making sense on one of these issues, you know, in her case, the problem of Islamist theocracy, and it becomes radioactive enough on the left that you have a it's a disorienting social experience. What shows up in your inbox is utterly disparaging and crazy and bad faith attacks from the left. And on the right, you kind of get love bombed by a cult, right? I mean, you meet, really friendly people who don't agree with much or of the rest of what you may believe, right? I mean, so, people on the right, when they hear me criticize Islam and its connection to jihadism and terrorism, following very much the line that Ayan would follow here. People on the right are so happy to have someone, left of center making sense on this issue that it really is just a completely congenial meeting of the minds, despite all of the other things I believe and will argue for that they find just odious. Right.
And then surprise.
So there's that. I mean, I don't know if you ever saw my interviews with Bill O'Reilly, but they all went this way where I would say something about Islam and it was a perfect meeting of the minds. And then I would switch to Christianity and it was basically the end of the segment.
And that's all the time we have.
Yeah, exactly. but the truth is the worst, the most dishonest, the most hostile, the most gaslighting, just the most insufferable attacks tend to come from the left, right? And it's now there's an asymmetry here or kind of an optical illusion, perhaps, because I'm not dealing with the far right. I'm not talking to neo-Nazis and anti-Semites, right? So obviously, right. What they would have to say to me would be, just as despicable and dishonest, I'm sure, in the end. But the truth is, I'm not even sure, given how crazy the far left has been. And, Ayan experienced this, and so many people have experienced this. And what many people have suffered, I would say, I've certainly resisted this, I think, successfully, but not everyone has. There's kind of a tractor beam effect where when you're getting nothing but disingenuous, nausea-inducing craziness on the left, and the right is showing itself willing to just bury the hatchet again and again and again, and we can agree to disagree about all these other things, but, we're nice guys over here. You see people get pulled getting captured by a new audience. And, I'm not going to name names here, but there, we have mutual friends who I think just now can't really make a lot of sense when talking about Trump and the election, say, because they have been captured by a right-wing audience that really treated them well, when the left treated them just despicably. And it's always, it's a kind of social and psychological experiment. And it's, I think it's something to be on guard for, not for political reasons, but just for reasons of making sense on these issues.
I like what you're saying. This is illuminating. I mean, because I know on the subject of religion, you're not a subscriber. Yeah. I know you don't like the term atheist because you don't need to be called that just because you don't happen to subscribe to religiosity in any form, but it's really a rejection of dogma. That's what you're a rejector of dogma. And I actually do like that. I feel like I too am a rejector of dogma, though I am, I don't think I can say a practicing Catholic, but I'm Catholic. I do believe in God. I don't believe in every story in the Bible. I'm trying to raise my kids Catholic, but I don't really subscribe to the dogmatic religious thinking. I kind of take what I want from it and use it to reinforce moral and ethical principles I believe in. I use God to threaten them, which works brilliantly. And that's sort of where I am. But I politically am very reticent to sign on for anybody's dogmatic thinking. And I think that's an advantage to me as a journalist. But I That's why I'm a registered independent. Why should I sign on to some party and their platform that I'm invariably going to have many disagreements with? Nobody out there has got exactly my ideological outlook. And why would I just put on their team jersey? I'm talking about as a citizen now. And just say, like, I'm going to support you. I think I'm always surprised when someone says they agree with everything on the Republican platform or everything on the Democratic platform. It's like, all of it? Did you look at it? Did you think about it for yourself? How did you get to that place? And so, I will confess that I can't even deal with the far left. I'm so over them. I really don't want anything to do with them. I have shut down my willingness to converse with them. I don't think they're honest brokers. I don't think they're coming at it in good faith. That's what I want to say about it. The left, I feel differently about. Liberals, I feel differently about. And I think Republicans, you know, my experiences with them have been largely positive. And so I understand what you're saying, the temptation to put on the jersey, but I haven't. I won't. It's just not the way I'm built. And I'm more skeptical of these groups and parties than I am loyal to them. And it's one of the reasons why I'm like a little concerned about, as I was saying before, the deification of Trump. Like, I understand defending him and giving him a fair shake, and I understand just thinking he's awesome, right? Like, I get those people. But what I see happening right now at some of these rallies where people are like, I will do whatever my president tells me to do. I will do what Donald Trump, he's sacrificed everything for me. I would die for him. I would die for him. People are saying that. And I don't totally understand how they got there or where that means we're going.
Yeah, well, this is where it crosses over into something like a political religion or a kind of pseudo spiritual awakening, right? It's just kind of a mass movement. And it's happened on the left. I mean, I would argue that what's happened around BLM has that character as well, right? Like it's not even trying to get in touch with facts, right? It feels too good to be right about this particular thing that you just don't want to, you know, you've achieved escape velocity somehow from the normal constraints of public discourse, and you're just soaring above the earth. And that's happened in Trumpistan. It's very strange. I mean, it's worth looking at the literature on cults to understand it. I mean, it's functioning by the same dynamics. I mean, the difference between a cult and a religion is really just in numbers of subscribers, from my view. I mean, once you get, you know, a billion subscribers, well, then it's simply indecent to call it a cult. I mean, that's a pejorative term. Here you're talking about most of the people in any given society. But if there's only 15 people in a house with a lot of, you know, burning candles, and they've got pictures on the mantle that no one can recognize, well, then that's a cult. And what the hell are you people up to? And what are you teaching your kids and all the rest? And so but if you really want to have an honest conversation about the way the world is and how we should all live together within it so as to stand a chance of maximizing human well-being or escaping the worst possible outcomes that are in fact possible, well, then you need to appeal to something deeper and something universalizable, right? Something that isn't born of the mere accidents of birth or geography or, you know, what religion your parents happen to have, or, you know, what politics they happen to have. And we know many people inherit their politics very much like a religion, right? You tend to just be following the line of your parents. And it is, yeah, it's weird. I mean, to come back to the point you made about platforms, it's weird that if you know someone's position on gun control, you know, you stand a good chance of knowing their position on climate change, right? Or right. On a dozen other things that should be unrelated to, and so it's a sign that people aren't thinking these problems through based on first principles. They're joining a team. They're joining a religion. They're part of a social experiment on some level.
Mm-hmm. It feels good to be part of a team.
It's tribalism. I mean, we're deeply tribal, and we you know, we're apes in that regard, and we're trying to leave the monkey behind here. And again, all we have is conversation by which to do it.
Now, I want to pick up on something you said about going forward in life and being focused on, you know, what matters and who we are as human beings. You're deep into meditation. You've studied it for years. You've practiced it for years. You've read all the books. You've spoken with all the gurus. But the thing that stood out to me and just reading up about this piece of your life was I read, this is a quote from you, "I've gone into silence for a week and meditated 18 hours a day just to see what can be revealed through disciplined use of attention, through introspection, and to see how it can inform the study of the mind." And then you didn't say anything more after that. And as somebody who doesn't meditate, I was wondering, could you like short form it for those of us who didn't do that? That seems like an important thing to know.
So I've spoken a lot about meditation in, I wrote a book, it appears in several of my books, but I wrote a book on the topic called Waking Up. And I have an app by that title where I and other people teach various techniques of meditation and talk about its connection to understanding the mind scientifically and just living an examined life altogether. I mean, just kind of rebooting the ancient philosophical project of developing a philosophy of life that actually matters, right? That actually changes one's moment to moment engagement with the world. And you know, aligning one's ethics and one's emotional life, and really trying to live a life that you don't regret in the end. I mean, you don't regret at the end of any given day or a given hour, but you don't regret at the end of your life. What would it mean to do that? And how can we do that? So that's really the kind of the center of gravity of my interest at this point. But yeah, with respect to sitting silent retreats, yeah, I did a lot of that, you know, mostly in my 20s. I spent about 2 years on silent meditation retreats, and the longest one was 3 months. And I did a couple of those, and then, you know, several, you know, 1 month and 2 month retreats, and then yes, you know,
you can't talk at all.
No, on some retreats you have an interview with a teacher every other day for about 10 minutes. So they just need to check in on you and guide your practice and make sure you're not losing your mind, as some small percentage of people do under those conditions, as you might imagine. But basically it is silence, and you're not even making eye contact with people. I mean, you really are kind of locked down. If you have no perspective on the nature of mind, prior to concepts, prior to your thinking incessantly about everything, prior to the conversation you're having with yourself, you are a mere hostage of that conversation, and it's an amazingly distorted conversation. I mean, you'll tell yourself the same thing 10 times in a row and never get bored, right? If someone walked into the room and spoke the same sentence to you over and over again, you know, you'd think they were crazy, and two, you would get out of the room, right? You'd say this is not worth my time. But when you look at the kinds of things you will tell yourself, and you know, every hour on the hour, every minute on the minute, right? When you're perseverating on something, when you're really caught by something, it is a psychotic dream, really. I mean, the difference between you and a psychotic in that case is that you have the good sense to keep your mouth shut, and the psychotic is verbalizing everything, you know, out on the sidewalk. But that's basically the difference, right? If you could just imagine your thoughts broadcast on a loudspeaker every moment of the day for all to hear, you know, we'd all sound crazy under those conditions. And meditation is a technique for recognizing the mechanics of all that and relinquishing it, you know, if only for moments at a time. And as you get better at it, you can, you know, get off the train for longer. And what you discover when you do that is that the mind is the basis for all the well-being you have ever experienced in your life. You know, it really is, there's an intrinsic quality to consciousness, you know, before anything changes, you know, in the very midst of any ordinary experience, you know, before you, you know, before the pain in your knee goes away. I mean, even in the midst of an unpleasant experience, there is a real freedom, right? A real sense of, you know, compassion for yourself and for others, and just a radical openness, right? And I mean, this is something that many people experience first, you know, taking, you know, one or another psychedelic, right? And this is what happened to me, you know, when I was 18, I took MDMA.
And I had to look that up. That's ecstasy. Yes.
Yeah. And, you know, and ecstasy, you know, it since became very popularized as a club drug, and people took it in comparatively, you know, frivolous ways. And it's not to say they didn't have a lot of fun in the process, but, you know, originally it was, you know, designed and taken by people, you know, very much with the intention of discovering something about the nature of their minds. And that was really the framing I had when I took it. And yeah, I discovered that it was possible to be much less of an asshole than I was tending to be, right? I mean, it was possible to be deeply at peace with myself and the world and to be happy, right? Like really, really happy down to my toes.
Oh. And then you're using the H word.
Yeah. And then you lose that, and then you become interested in why, right? Like what is it about how I'm using my attention that reliably produces something less than the deepest peace and satisfaction and love and connection that I've ever experienced, right? Which how am I failing to actualize that day after day? And that's when a practice like meditation becomes relevant to people.
Can you get yourself there? Can you get yourself to the ecstasy version of yourself through meditation?
Yeah, definitely. Although that isn't actually the primary goal. It's the primary goal of certain types of meditation. So in a Buddhist context, there's a meditation called metta, which is the Pali word for loving kindness. And in that practice, you are trying to create a specific state of mind, very much like what many people have experienced on ecstasy, which is, you know, unconditional love, for lack of a better word. But I mean, it really is that. It's you recognize that love is a state of being that you can fall into more and more deeply, and it really just, it's not transactional. It's not like you love someone because, you know, because of your history with them, because of all the good things they did for you, because of, you know, because of how much fun you have in their presence. No, it's, you can actually recognize that you really want other people to be happy. You really want them to be free of suffering. And the depth of that wanting, the depth of that commitment to the well-being of other people, even people you've never met, right? Even people who are your enemies, who are working hard to make themselves your enemies, right? You can stand back from your kind of your reactivity and your kind of the personal aspect of those collisions, and recognize that on some basic level, everyone is suffering. Everyone is going to lose everything they love in this world. You know, everyone is we're all in this astonishing circumstance together. And what you want, even for the bad people, is an end to suffering. I mean, you want people to be happy, and that is that wanting is a state of mind that you can focus on. And so metta practice is the practice of amplifying that intention and emotion to the point where, yeah, it just obliterates everything else in your mind for the time that you're doing that practice. So you just feel a depth of love for everyone, you know, for no reason other than the fact that that's what you feel for them, right? You actually just, mm-hmm. because no matter how bad they are, and it's, I mean, this may sound, you know, bizarre or its own in its own way pathological to people. But I mean, just take, you know, take one of the worst people who's ever lived, right? So there are many people on this list. You know, I wouldn't Hitler. Put Trump on this list. As, you know, it might surprise some people, but you take.
I was going to ask you whether you've meditated on him.
I mean, so he's harder than most people to feel compassion for reasons that are interesting. But you take someone like.
Let's go with Hitler.
No, my favorite for this use case is Uday Hussein, right? So one of Saddam Hussein's sons, you know, his worst son, right? So this, I mean, he is just the prototypical evil person, right? He's no question, he was a psychopath. And this was a guy who, when he was driving through Baghdad with his bodyguards and he would see a wedding in progress, they would descend on the wedding and he would rape the bride. And in certain cases, he killed the bride. I mean, he did this in more than one case, right? It's just the most despicable human being you can imagine, right? So how could you feel love or compassion for Uday Hussein? Well, just look at his lifeline as a whole, right? Just roll back the clock on him and think of him as the four-year-old Uday Hussein, right? So how do you feel about the four-year-old, right? Well, he may have been a psychotic kid too. I don't know. He may have been a scary little boy. I wouldn't doubt it, but he was above all a really unlucky one, right? First of all, he had Saddam Hussein as a father, right? I mean, how unlucky can you get? And he was the four-year-old boy who was on track to become the very scary man who, you know, we wound up killing, you know, happily. I mean, that's exactly what we should have done with him, given who he was and given the fact that we couldn't capture him. But it is appropriate to feel compassion for the four-year-old boy who became Uday Hussein. I mean, that is an unlucky life. Through no fault of his own. He didn't pick his genes. He didn't pick his parents. He didn't decide to be born into a war-torn, honor-based society that would amplify all of his flaws, right? And so you can feel compassion for that boy. And then the question is, at what point is it illegitimate to feel compassion for him, right? When he's five, when he's six, when he's seven, when he's eight, like when does he cross over into no longer being an appropriate target for your well-intentioned wish that he just be happy, that he just overcome suffering? And you can get there. I mean, you can really get there with the worst people, but that actually is not the center of the bullseye, as far as I'm concerned, for meditation in general. I mean, in general, meditation is not about producing specific states of mind like loving kindness. It's about recognizing that ordinary consciousness, and just the consciousness that is hearing my words right now. I mean, just the consciousness that's allowing the two of us to have a conversation, is already free of self.
Sam Harris, living an examined life. I love that. That's inspirational to me. It does, and see where that goes, and see how it makes you feel and get really honest about the answers to both of those things. That I think I can do. Today's episode was brought to you in part by Jan Marini Skin Research. Dramatic results, dermatologists recommend it. Get your award-winning skincare system now at janmarini.com. Want to tell everybody that next show, which is on Wednesday, is going to be with two people who are spectacular. Andy McCarthy of National Review, who is the one lawyer who's been super smart on all the Trump legal challenges, really fair to the president too, unlike most. And Selena Zito, who I've corresponded with a bunch online, but I've never actually met her. And she's somebody who, I love her voice and I love the angles she pursues on stories. She's one of those folks who gets flyover country and isn't disdainful of it. So I think those are two great people to talk to. Well, it'll be, you know, our first show after the Electoral College meets and votes today. And we'll get their take on where we are and what's going to happen, you know, between now and January 20th. Sound counsel and thoughts from two smart, likable people. That's the kind of show I love. If you don't want to miss it, go over there and subscribe. Make sure you're a subscriber. That helps. That lets me come right into your inbox in the morning, the top of your phone saying, hey, don't forget me today. come listen to me talk to Selena. And then, of course, you've got to download and you've got to rate 5 stars. And more than anything, send me a review, will you? It's been fun to read them. People make me laugh. Some people swear. Some people ramble on. Some people write weird sexual things. Don't do that. But I do like hearing from you. And any guest ideas are good, too. A lot of new names that I hadn't even heard of. And then I sent my team to go Google and find and call in some circumstances. So anyway, it's been a pleasure and to be continued after we have results from the Electoral College. Talk to you Wednesday. Thanks for listening to The Megyn Kelly Show. No BS, no agenda, and no fear. The Megyn Kelly Show is a Devil May Care media production in collaboration with Red Seat Ventures.
Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match two of your favorite breakfast items, including a sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and hash browns. Make it even better with a delicious medium iced coffee. With McDonald's Mix and Match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price.